Okay, thank you. We're pleased to have Deborah Fischer from Yale University giving the next talk, and it's on metallicity and mass trends in the radial velocity database.
Okay, Deborah. Thank you. Are you gonna talk? Is there a laser pointer? Okay, thanks again to the organizers for really a wonderful conference and some exciting results this morning. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the trends that we see in the, at least among the Doppler detected planets, so the radial velocity detected planets. And as you know, in the last decade and a half, there have been a growing number of planets that have been discovered. And it has this interesting characteristic with a sort of pile up here at the low mass end of M sine I. And so we see some features, some correlations between the existence, the occurrence, the formation of extrasolar planets and metallicity and mass of the host stars. So that's what I'll be presenting today. In the review paper by Udry and Santos, they discuss the statistical properties of exoplanets. And here you see in the top plot two histograms showing metallicity from solar to subsolar to metal-rich stars, and then, of course, the number of planets. And what's really quite interesting is that from these two surveys, one carried out with Corley data, the other using Lick, Keck, and actually AAT data as well, we see essentially the same trend with a growing rise in the fraction of planets, the fraction of stars that have planets going from solar metallicity, where it's something like 5-ish% to metal-rich stars with something like 25%. And this correlation, that's not me, is it? Thank God, it could be.
It was just you.
It could be. And this correlation really holds for gas giant planets. And as I'll show you in a moment, we see something different for the rocky planets. So in the Corley data, the analysis was carried out by Nuno Santos, Garrick Israeli, and Michelle Mayor, 2004. This blue curve shows the metallicity distribution for 98 planet hosts, and they also included a 41-star volume-limited comparison sample. In our analysis, we actually analyzed all of the stars that were on the CPS sample, and then made this, and then also looked to see which of those 850-ish stars had uniform detectability for gas giant planets. And then after binning the stars by metallicity, asked what fraction of stars in each bin have gas giant planets, okay? And I think this is almost impervious to any sort of a bias. These are the stars that we're looking at, and it's just what fraction of those stars have planets. And then in this paper, Udry and Santos have taken the average of these two distributions and fit with a polynomial curve and showed that the occurrence of planets goes roughly as the number of particles squared. Okay. So again, this analysis is restricted to stars that have detected planets with periods shorter than about 3 or 4 years and with velocity amplitudes greater than 30 meters a second, so that we could really have a complete sort of analysis. We've actually redone our analysis. You heard this morning that everybody's redoing their Doppler analysis. We're also redoing our spectral synthesis modeling, which is how we analyze the metallicity and temperature of the star. So instead of one way to carry out metallicity analysis is with a curve of growth analysis, and instead we create a synthetic model, and the free parameters are things like effective temperature and V sine I, the individual abundances and the surface gravity. And when we change our free parameters to match our observation, we have a good fit and we say we know what the star really is made out of, what the parameters are. Of course, these parameters can be degenerate. And one of the most difficult parameters to fit is the surface gravity. And we were really never happy with our gravity distribution, which showed the M dwarfs having gravities that were actually too high. So we've carried out a new analysis. Jeff Valenti has written some code to basically go into the Y2 isochrones and iteratively solve for these parameters, temperature, abundance, gravity, and then take those values and go to the Yale isochrones and figure out where the star fits along the isochrone. And when you do that, you get a stellar mass, a luminosity, an age, and a surface gravity. Okay, so we have two ways now of tying the surface gravity together. And then using the surface gravity that we got from the isochrone analysis, we would iterate, we now iterate and go back and carry out another metallicity or spectral synthesis model. And sometimes this iteration will run for 20 or 30 iterations until our answers converge. And we get a surface gravity that agrees between the spectral synthesis model and the isochrone analysis. And this has demonstrably improved our results. It's tightened up the surface gravities and the HR diagrams that we get from our analysis. So we think that this is going to be a better technique. We're analyzing all of the main sequence stars, so the SPOX 1 catalog of F, G, and K type stars. But we're also adding SPOX 4, which are the subgiants. That should be submitted soon. SPOX 3, which are the giants. SPOX 2, which are an extension of the main sequence stars. So we had to number them out of order so that we would have this cute tie-in to the luminosity class of the star. And these should be coming out soon. Now, we have a small number, okay, relatively small number of exoplanets with relatively low masses, but we see that the distribution is distinctly flatter than what we saw for the gas giant planets, right, with a steep rise here. And so this suggests that the process for making these smaller planets, especially the rocky planets, might not require as many metals as the gas giant planets require to build up their cores. There's been a lot of attention, of course, on individual abundances, and this interesting result by Garrick Israelian et al. Showed that there was enhanced lithium depletion in stars with planets. So if you look at this plot, here's a temperature range of about 150 degrees Kelvin. And plotted on the y-axis is the lithium abundance. Okay, and so the black empty circles are the control sample, the sample of stars where planets have not been detected. And then the red dots are lithium abundances for stars with planets. And so from this plot, what they conclude that the stars that have planets have lower lithium abundances, that this distribution is statistically different from the stars without planets. So the whole distinction of with and without planets kind of bothers me, frankly, because just because we don't see them yet doesn't mean that they actually aren't there. And if this is correct, you know, we don't really understand what the mechanism is, right? Why would the stars with planets lose their lithium preferentially? You might, in fact, expect that they would have late stage accretion that would actually add lithium into the upper convective zone. But perhaps it was suggested that the planets induce extra mixing in the stars. So if you're right, then based on this hypothesis, you would conclude that 50% of the stars don't have planets. In other words, if planets are required to force this lithium depletion, right, then these stars don't have planets, or maybe all of these stars do, and we just haven't found them yet. There have been other analyses that have been carried out looking at the refractive and volatile element abundances to try to find signs of accretion, late stage accretion. And I think these are mostly ambiguous, but it's a long story, of course, and most of you have heard this already, that, you know, is this phenomenon of metal richness among planet-hosting stars, for at least the gas giant planet-hosting stars, due to accretion, or is it an initial condition? And I think that this was an impressive analysis carried out by Pinceno et al., showing that if it's accretion, and you imagine that, you know, Norm Murray suggested that if you plop in something like 5 Earth masses of rocky material, that's what you might expect, that as a function of temperature here on the x-axis, that the hotter stars with very thin convective zones should have dramatically increased metallicities. And so this Fe on H measurement for different initial values of Fe on H, so for solar metallicity, for slightly lower than solar metallicity, and for metal-rich stars, shows that in all cases, you know, a little bit of accretion, something like, in fact, these three curves are adding 1, 3, and 10 Earth masses of rocky material to the stars, and assuming that it stays in the convective envelope, right, that it should, we should see metallicities way up here, you know, something like 0.6 or 1. We don't see that. So I think that was reason to suspect that it's not accretion that we're looking at. This metallicity correlation is not caused by accretion, but it's an initial condition of a metal-rich cloud. And at about the same time, the analysis was carried out by Santos, Israeli, and Mayor. Mayor is showing that the, you know, again, as a function of convective zone mass, you know, adding a little bit of metals really drives up the metallicity. And here's the distribution of stars with and without planets, and in no cases do we see any of these super metal-rich stars. So if it's an accretion phenomenon, then the planets are punching through, or the refractory elements are punching through the convective zone. But if that's true, then you don't have a mass metallicity correlation, right? So because to pollute the entire volume of the star is just too much to ask. We also don't see a functional dependence of metallicity on temperature or stellar mass. This is looking at the problem in two different from two different perspectives: depth of the convective zone and also depth of the convective zone. But again, we don't see this rise in metallicity as we go to massive stars or hot stars. And then finally, for me, the nail in the coffin was that looking at the subgiants, that as the stars, as the main sequence stars evolve across the subgiant branch, then the convective zone deepens, and you would expect that any polluted, thin convective zone would be diluted by material from deep in the star. But what we see is that the subgiants without planets have the same metallicity distribution as the main sequence stars with planets. That's a good check. But also the subgiants with planets have the same metal-rich distribution as the stars without planets, okay? And that can really only happen if the stars are metal-rich through and through. Now, it's possible that I think with Kepler astroseismology and a long timeline baseline of data, we'll get some interesting measurements of metallicity gradients in the stars, which will be quite fascinating and also bear on this. And furthermore, we see no metallicity gradient across the subgiant branch. So it's not, you know, just looking at the subgiants that have a small convective zone, but even as they go across the subgiant branch and the convective zone continues to get deeper and deeper, there's no decrease in the metallicity. So this led us all to conclude that it's what we were seeing was an initial condition. Metal-rich clouds preferentially form metal-rich stars, preferentially form gas giant planets, okay? And so just when we thought it was safe to go out in the water again, this interesting result came out by Pasquini et al. In 2007, where they analyzed the metallicity of 14 planet-hosting giant stars, shown here in the blue, and compared that with the metallicity distribution for planet-hosting dwarfs, in the red dash curve, which they drew these metallicities from John Schneider's Encyclopedia of Exoplanets. So again, one caution, I don't think it's what's going on here, but one caution is that any comparison of a sample, say for giant stars, to, you know, another sample that somebody else analyzed is always going to be, you know, on shaky ground. I don't think that's what's going on here. I think that this is probably real. We've looked at the K-giant sample as well, and we're seeing a difference. But I think the interpretation, okay, of this as being an accretion signature is perhaps what's not quite right. So although they concluded that the planet metallicity correlation was caused by accretion, and now in the K-giants you're seeing these really deep convective zones and lots of dilution, there's another explanation, and that is that these stars are more massive, right? And so maybe it's a mass correlation that we're actually looking at. This figure I saw years ago, made by Greg Laughlin, and I just made up a date because I can't remember when when he showed it to me. But it's he had this sort of quadrature space, right, of metallicity, so going to high or low metallicity on the vertical axis, and low mass stars and high mass stars. And what we see is, you know, nicely represented by this schematic. I mean, it stuck with me for all these years, that high metallicity and high mass stars mean more planets. Low metallicity low metallicity or low mass stars mean fewer planets, correlate with fewer planets. So the bottom line, you know, when we look at this plot, is that what we're, you know, the issue is really surface density. It's really number of particles at the midplane of the protoplanetary disk that's going to be important. We'd like to be able to tie this result together, this observational, you know, end stage, together with the initial conditions in disks of new forming stars. But, you know, and we certainly have some rich information showing, you know, lifetimes of disks here in this plot, which we've all used and thought about it a lot in terms of, you know, forming planets by core accretion versus gravitational instability. But unfortunately, these data aren't really adequate to measure disk lifetimes as a function of stellar mass yet. So that would be something really interesting to know, to understand whether or not, let's say, the M dwarfs lose their disks sooner than the F dwarfs, or vice versa. We do have a model, again, Laughlin, Bodenheimer, and Adams in 2004, ran models of core accretion and found that the mass growth of the core is proportional to terms like surface density of the disk, the Keplerian frequency, so the period, how often it's encountering other particles, the Hill radius, and the core radius. And what they found is that for the blue depicts the solar type stars. On the y-axis, we have the mass of the core in Earth masses, and then a time in millions of years going from 0 to 12 million years. And for the solar type stars, the planetesimal builds up to embryos that are 50 Earth masses in something like 3 million years. Okay, but following this core accretion with the assumptions of a lower surface density disk around M dwarfs, the planet doesn't reach a 14 Earth mass core until about 10 million years. And you saw from the previous slide that by then the disk is essentially gone, and there's little chance for an M dwarf to now grow, at least by core accretion, and develop a massive envelope for a gas giant planet. Okay, so the metallicity, the conclusion then from metallicity, as far as I can see, gas giant planets correlated with high metallicity, okay, which is really probably a correlation with surface density in the disk. We don't see that same correlation, as Michelle pointed out this morning, for the low mass stars. So here's the mass distribution of the stars that we're looking at on the CPS, the California Planet Search Project. And you see the classic, you know, FG K dwarf distribution, okay, of our current stars. But we're also adding in a lot of stars in the low mass and in the high mass regime. At low masses, we've started a project with Eric Guidos and Sebastian Lapine, who has this nice proper motion catalog and has identified 1,600 M dwarfs that are relatively nearby and brighter than V equals 11. And so we're trying to cycle through these stars very quickly, taking a few consecutive observations, looking for stars that show RMS scatter consistent with a planet, and trying to characterize the frequency of planets, at least close-in planets for the M dwarfs, so stars less than 0.6 solar masses. We're also trying to push on finding out what's happening at the massive end. And you heard this morning there are a number of surveys looking at evolved stars. Bunye Sato and others have been looking at K giants, Andreas Kirnbach and his crew. And we're also trying to, and John Johnson has this very large project looking at subgiants, okay? And he's finding an incredibly high frequency of planets around the subgiant stars. Now, the subgiants are interesting because they're, as progenitor stars, were A stars. So his papers are all called retired A stars. They're moving across the subgiant branch. They're cooling off so that we can, you know, their rotation is breaking so that we can actually hope to get good Doppler measurements. There's also something interesting in the types of planets that he's finding. The planets are fairly massive themselves, and the planets seem to preferentially be found in relatively wide orbits. So very few hot Jupiters around the subgiant stars, these A-type stars. And so one might ask whether this is an evolutionary effect. As the star is evolving, something happens interacts with the planets. And so we're trying to push up the main sequence branch just using the CAT telescope at Lick Observatory to look at more mid to late F-type stars and distinguish whether or not this is evolution or mass. So as I said, the subgiant stars seem to have more massive planets. So here's stellar mass, and then the mass of the planet in Jupiter masses, not very well labeled, sorry. And it's interesting that there are very few planets found in this regime. Okay, and so one might wonder whether or not this is just radial velocity jitter in the subgiants. And we're looking at this, carrying out an analysis of stars on the California Planet Search Project. And this is a plot of what we think the RV noise floor is for the subgiants. So it's something like 3 meters a second, right? And so certainly these, for close-in planets, we'd be able to populate this regime, but they seem not to be there. Maybe this is as the progenitor stars are more luminous, and that affects the inner part of the disk planet formation. So John Johnson has carried out a new analysis of the metallicity and mass correlation. And he, in this analysis, assumes that the mass and the metallicity act independently, okay, that they're independent parameters on the formation of gas giant planets, and comes up with an enhancement when he includes a mass term in this analysis. You can see, by the way, that this slope that he's fit this in a different way. We just, with the Valente and Fisher fit, and I think with Nuno Santos's fit as well, we just fit a weighted curve through the points with error bars, and he's carried out a Bayesian analysis, and he gets a slightly shallower slope. So I think this is, for me, the centerpiece that I'd like to kind of leave you with. This is a plot that he's generated. Okay, again, the metallicity is on the y-axis, and the mass of the stars on the x-axis. And he's roughly divided this plot into three bins, okay? The M dwarfs, the FGK dwarfs, and then the retired A stars, mostly retired A stars. So there are a lot of interesting features. There's a lot of information contained in this plot. First of all, the planet metallicity correlation still seems to hold. The metallicity of the general population is shown here with the black line, and the stars with planets are the mean is plotted with a red line. So you can see that stars with planets are more metal rich than the general population of stars without planets. And again, these are gas giant planets. I think that what's really quite interesting is the gap between these, which continues to narrow as you go from low mass stars to high mass stars. So in order for the M dwarfs to have detected gas giant planets, they have to compensate for their low stellar mass, right? Only 4%, in an absolute sense, M dwarfs have fewer gas giant planets than more massive stars. 4% of M dwarfs have planets, 20% of these, you know, subgiant stars have planets. And, you know, here with the M dwarfs, there is no convective zone, right? I mean, the whole star is convective. This is not just skin deep metallicity. And so we're seeing a real effect that, you know, the metallicity helps. This metallicity, by the way, was calculated by Johnson and Apps using a photometric calibration to binary star systems, a very nice work. Okay, so the gap between metalloceiver planet hosts relative to non-detections closes as the stellar mass increases. And stellar mass and metallicity are correlated, right? So there's some slope, at least in these lines. So coming back to this, I'm not sure that stellar mass and metallicity are independent parameters. It seems to me that the key fact is the number of refractory elements that you can pack into the midplane of the protoplanetary disk. And you can either do that if you're a low-mass star by having high metallicity, okay, or if you're a high-mass star with low metallicity, simply by virtue of the number of particles that you're putting into the midplane of the disk. So I come back to this nice depiction that Greg Laughlin made a long time ago. And I think that, you know, it's true that this vector for more planets, more gas giant planets, is really a surface density issue. Well, okay, you've already seen these plots. Disadvantage of going later. But one of the things that I think is particularly useful in thinking towards the future about mass and metallicity correlations are these population synthesis models that have been run, we heard, by Ida and Lynn, which predict what the number of planets that you expect to find as a function of mass and separation for different parameterizations of viscosity in the disk, or metallicity, or mass of the host star. And this has been done also recently by Mortesini in this lovely paper. And it leaves us with a nice prediction, right? If this is the population that's predicted by core accretion, then this plot, so the solid line shows the population, right, with these gaps that have been discussed this morning, that are predicted by the core accretion technique. And these simulations show, these three, if you can see the dotted and dashed curves here, show what we expect to detect, okay? So we're only, right, we have a curtain. We can't see the low-mass planets. And as we pull this curtain back by achieving better and better precision, so from 10 to 1 to 0.1 meter per second Doppler precision, you know, only then can we really begin to intrude on this parameter space and figure out what's going on. So I look forward to the time when we can get down certainly below 1 meter per second. And that's it. Thank you.
Open the floor up to questions.
So you mentioned the metallicity, which is iron to hydrogen.
Yeah.
What about other elements like oxygen, for example, which would be elemental
right.
for building ice and water?
Right, and I should mention your nice work as well. So the elements like oxygen are difficult to actually analyze, but there are proxies like silicon and titanium, for example, and so we are looking at those. And with this new sample, we'll look at this more closely for a sign of core accretion. But I don't have that information for you right now. It's a great question, good thing to look at.
When you've done these recent analyses of planet abundance versus metallicity or stellar mass, would the solar system, would the sun be considered to have planets or not have planets?
That's a good question. 5%, according to this analysis, the sun would not fall into our box. Yeah, because we would say that 5% of stars like the sun, the sun would not fall into our box. Yes, my phone down. because our box wasn't big enough, okay? It didn't extend out to large semi-major axes to include Jupiter. So for planets with Jupiter-like planets in three-year orbits or less, yeah, our sun wouldn't do it.
Okay.
Yeah, so very much along the same lines of that question, there's another axis to Greg's plot, right, which you sort of suppressed, which is that is the distance from the star. In fact, I think most of the planets you're talking about almost certainly migrated a substantial amount from where they're formed, if we believe the canonical theories for how planets form. So, and I'll talk about a little bit tomorrow, in microlensing we're coming up with a somewhat different answer in terms of the frequency of planets around low-mass stars, which may be telling us something about migration. So I guess I have a question in this, which is, what is that limit that you guys are actually talking about?
Okay, so the box of parameter space that we're looking at are planets with periods shorter than 4 years, okay, and amplitudes greater than 20 meters per second. So they're Saturns or Jupiters, and we had to define it that way to get a clean sample. Now, you know, the new data that we have, because since 2005, right, we've got another 4 or 5 years of data, and so we're going to be able to push that out and have a significant number of stars out to about 6 years.
So going back to the lithium correlation, it's tempting for a theorist to speculate that the reason for the enhanced lithium with no planet is because those stars have actually eaten their planets. Any thought on how that ties in the subgiant data? That
okay, wait, sorry, so if you eat the planet, then how do you lose lithium?
Oh, well, you don't. So the fact that the observed the fact that stars that observed planets have depleted lithium might not be due to lithium depletion, but due to a lower lithium baseline that is enhanced by stars not having planets because they ate them. We're not seeing planets around the enhanced lithium stars precisely
right.
Because they've already been eaten. Is that?
Oh, because they've already been eaten. Oh yes. Okay. Right. Okay.
Does that fit in, for example, JJ's work?
No, because actually, if you look at the timescales for lithium depletion, they're really quite short, and you'd see. Well, you kind of do see a difference, right, in his plot. There are a couple of stars that have relatively thin convective envelopes, and they sit, you know, a little high. But the time scale for lithium depletion is pretty short, so I think that any accretion signature gets lost.
Okay, I wanted to touch on a point that Scott mentioned. Basically, the latest microlensing results have a frequency of planets out at around 10-year periods that's significantly higher than I think any of the other samples. We see
right.
Maybe a third of.
Right.
These are planets, the targets are typically are half a solar mass, and the planets themselves are maybe a Saturn mass. So it's like low-mass gas giants that haven't migrated.
Right. So it's a fabulous result that, yeah, and it's exploring a parameter space that we can't touch, virtually can't touch. So it's a challenge for the theorists, right, to put these together, yeah.
So I just want to make a comment on the importance of sort of mass as sort of the second parameter sort of in the metallicity trends. And that's the fact that is, you know, most of us who do the models, one of the things we often have to include is that the metallicity of the disk, while it may start at the metallicity of the star, it's something that definitely evolves. As
sure.
You say, as solids settle towards the midplane, the gas starts to evolve separately. And so, of course, then it's the more massive disks around the more massive stars, which then have the greater potential to evolve towards a higher metallicity state, which then brings everything into consistency. And this is then, you know, something that Anders is going to talk about in relation to the planetesimal formation models.
Right, right. Yes, good point.
Yes, I have two comments. One, when you are using the terminology retired A star for stars on the JN bunch, I'm not sure about my souvenir when I was students of that A star do not have a JN bunch. If you are looking for the cluster of Pleiades, and the JN bunch belong mostly to stars with smaller masses, early F stars, something like this. And I remember saw a paper by Scalo many years ago that the typical mass of this object was 1.1 solar masses. So I doubt that this kind of population is so different, or the JN bunch is so different from the solar type stars we have on the main sequence. And maybe the lack of low metallicity you observe on the JN bunch, because it's an effect of age, because you have an increase of metallicity in the velocity. So I'm not sure that it's these objects are really notably more massive than on the typical FGK stars sample.
Right, right. So the masses come from isochrone analysis, and they go up to about 2.5 solar masses. And I think that what's happened is that in the last 2 years, the samples expanded quite a bit at Keck. So when John Johnson started his survey at Lick Observatory, he had to stick to the brighter stars. And it's true, they were closer stars and, you know, typically, they were a little lower in mass, but he's really pushed up to.
Because due to the mass function of the main seconds, that you considerably favorized low mass object. So maybe you have few massive object, but most of them will have a relatively, let's say 1.1 typically. Solar masses. So
yeah. Okay.
I was working
well, we
many years ago.
Yeah.
And my second point, you in one of the slides you mentioned that the different people having contributed to the two aspects of the scenario, accretion or initial condition, and you put Israelian et al. In the box of accretion, and it's exactly the reverse of the
okay.
paper.
Sorry.
They say they claim it's only due to initial condition.
Okay.
So it should be the same box as Pearson.
All right. I think you're right. Yes, yes, of course. My apologies. Yes.
There's been a request that the questioners identify themselves in advance.
Right. This is Mark Wyatt. So with your improved estimates of ages, do you see any evidence for evolution in the orbital elements, such as in eccentricity?
Have not yet looked, actually, but that's a good question. Yeah.
Okay, I'm Dave Charbonneau, and the question I had was about, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the robustness of spectroscopic determinations of the metallicity of M dwarfs.
Right.
Because you showed that nice three-panel plot.
Right.
And am I understanding correctly that you're evaluating the metallicity, but the metallicity is being evaluated using a different technique?
Absolutely.
So you're comparing, and they're quite different in that the metallicity of M dwarfs are being determined by John Johnson's photometric calibration.
That's right, looking at height above the main sequence.
And for the sun-like stars, it's spectroscopic.
Right.
So what I'm wondering is, and it gets to the fact that basically you don't have those nice iron lines.
Yeah.
They're just not there. They're not present in the spectrum, right?
And you have all those not nice, you know, molecular features that cause that we don't have any atomic line data for.
So I guess my question is just, could you speak a little bit about?
Right.
You have these spectra. What are the possibilities to get metallicity?
Right.
Whether that means iron or whether that means other elements.
Right.
And really put those on the same basis as the sun-like stars.
Right. No, that's a great point. So we've been it's true that the and I mentioned this too, that for the M dwarfs, those metallicities came from the calibration of Johnson and Apps to photometry. The photometry was calibrated to the Valenti and Fisher metallicities. So there is a bit of a tie-in there. But you're right. It's a different technique. Now we would love to analyze spectroscopically the M dwarfs, and there's a huge effort that's going on, especially with Jeff Valenti and Nikolai Piskunov, to try and expand the Vienna Atomic Line database to include molecular features, which it does right now, but more importantly, to tune up those molecular line data so that it's astrophysical. I mean, for the atomic line data, right, which is order of magnitude simpler, I still spent a couple of years tuning up that line list that we used. So it's something we want to do. I honestly don't see this on the horizon of the next 2 or 3 years. I see it as a kind of 10 years from now, being able to do better spectroscopic analysis with the synthesis models that we have. So line by line, we're getting better, but there are a lot.
And that's going to be a daunting problem.
Yeah.
Thanks. Rashmi Madhuri. I think this is related. Can you go back to that plot where you had the M dwarfs and the et cetera?
That's a beautiful plot.
Can you just explain why there's the jumps? You may have said it before, but I missed it.
The jumps between the population without non-planets and with?
No, well,
planets?
Red lines up there, then down there.
Oh, and then down, yeah. Why it's not a continuous slope, exactly. Well, I mean, and here as well. So it's been, the distribution has been artificially broken into these three bins and then fit separately with a linear trend. And so without an enforcement of the boundary condition, right? And so it's, I think the thinking is that they're, you know, these stars are fully convective and, yeah, no, it's a good point. I don't know. Yeah, they should be continuous. You're absolutely right. I can't. Yeah. They would be continuous. The interesting thing is that, you know, they would, I think you'd also see this gap narrowing, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. No, that I actually think is right, that that what we're seeing is, you know, again, that these M dwarfs, which are fully convective or nearly fully convective, are low mass and require this high metallicity to increase the surface density. So I think you would see that as you go to the really massive stars, that you don't need that much of a metallicity enhancement.
Renu Malhotra. This is, I have to preface this question, that this is from partial ignorance, or incomplete ignorance, maybe I should put it. It's about the lithium depletion.
Right.
When planets are eaten by stars.
Yeah.
I think that my recollection is that the key observation should be not lithium, but rather the lithium. There are
lithium
two isotopes
lithium
of,
seven,
of
right.
lithium
right.
6 and 7.
Right.
And it's the ratio of the two.
Right.
That's the key to
right.
to. Okay, so there's no hope of that. I'm hearing this. Good.
Yeah. Sorry. So no, but that was a good point, and other people want to know. So the ratio of the lithium 6 isotope to lithium 7 would be an accretion signature, as you said. But yeah, measuring lithium 6 is virtually impossible because noise and other line blends and so forth. So it's really hard to disentangle that. That's a really tough measurement to make. Yeah, right.
Yes, maybe part of this discussion. It's, in fact, the lithium depletion with stars with giant planets, not with planets, but with giant planets, is probably due to some kind of, if the accretion disk is massive enough, you modify the structure of the convective zone, and this is in effect able to destroy the lithium. It's not related to accretion of planets, because accretion of planets will have exactly the reverse effect.
Yeah. This is Ruth Marie Clay. So what is the source of the metallicity dependence with mass for the stars without planets?
What is the source of the metallicity dependence for stars?
Mass.
You mean, I'm not sure. Let's see.
The black line is just the
measurement of metallicity in this population.
So why do higher mass stars have more metals?
Yeah, I'm always nervous about saying that the age relation, but it is true that statistically, you know, this is a somewhat older population than this, but it's a very fuzzy ground to sort of tread, the metallicity age relation. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? If not, let's thank Deborah once again.
I'm done.